認 OK。
Welcome nerds to this edition of the Dice Section. Thanks for coming back. I'm Dave Kirby once again. And once again, we have Michael Harrison.
Hello, Dave. How are you?
I'm great. We also have Jeff Marochnik.
I'm not a nerd.
Well, I wasn't saying it to you. I was saying it to them.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And they have no such illusions about themselves. They know what they are, just as
wait,
I do.
Wait, Jeff, is there something wrong with being a nerd?
That's not what we're talking about tonight. We're moving on.
We're talking about nerd games, not nerds, all right?
We're going to talk about Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective tonight, which is a pretty unique game that I think we agree on a lot of things about it. We also disagree on a few things, maybe? I'm not sure. I'm going to have to take like tonight's very current temperature from the three of us before I really know.
It's a mystery, and we'll get to the bottom of that mystery.
Man, that's just hot stuff. It's going to be a 30-second clip that someone can find on Facebook at facebook.com/dissection. First, though, we want to talk about another game that takes place in the late 1880s, and it's Sunless Sea, which is a PC roguelike, heavily story-driven game. It's from Fail Better Games. It's in the world of Fallen London, which was the first product they ever put out. It was a free-to-play sort of stamina-driven, browser-based game that also eventually saw some smartphone releases. For some reason, in this world of 1880, London is a mile or so beneath the surface of the Earth. Who knows why? I don't know. I'm sure you find out if you play a lot of Fallen London. But what I've played a lot of, and I think Jeff has played a lot of, and Michael has played some of, is Sunless Sea. It's a game set in this world where you do a lot of venturing around the Untersee, which is the ocean within the Earth. It's like heavily Lovecraftian. There's a lot of stuff that can happen. You're going to like float around and be desperate about whether you have enough fuel and food to keep your ship and your crew going. And then you're going to run into people who are maybe from hell. Or maybe they're talking mushroom people. Or maybe they're sentient apes that love to possess human souls or whatever. But I think we're all pretty high on Sunless Sea, right?
Well, I would disagree with you, first of all, on the fact that it's a heavily Lovecraftian game. I think that it's one of the delightful things about it is that it's lightly Lovecraftian, and it's lightly 19th century steampunky. It's lightly a whole bunch of weird, mysterious kinds of things. I'm betting that there actually isn't, like, I've played a bit of the Fallen London game, and there's... I don't think that it's a game that's designed to be anything other than weird for the sake of weird. The background of it, and that's part of what makes, I think, probably the fact that they've written so much about this so easy, because all they have to do is just come up with like these single paragraph snippets of oddness to add to the background. That the game itself is really honestly not that it's not a fantastically interesting game. But it's, well, no, I mean, I've played, God knows, let me pull up Steam here. I've played like 38 hours of this damn thing. So it's an engrossing game, but it's not, like you're just driving a boat around, the ocean.
You know what it actually reminded me of was like a BBS door game.
Yes. Yes.
Like there's not a whole lot of, I mean, you steer your ship around and everything, and you go from port to port, and you actually do it. But part of me kind of thinks that if they removed that part of the game, I mean, it would still be entertaining. It would still be interesting. There would still be, like, reading these weird-ass snippets of strange fiction and kind of, like, shipping goods from place to place.
I've thought that very much, too, right? Like, well, I have to say, by the way, Jeff, you're right to call me wrong for saying it was heavily Lovecraftian. What I really meant was it was lightly Lovecraftian, right? Because there's like a lot of there's a lot of influences that are pretty clear in this game, in the setting that they've created, and it's sort of just like everything that was ever cool that might have ever happened in the 1880s, in any alternate reality is accessible here. And then
it's
I agree with you, Michael. Like, I agree with you, right? Like, what you're playing this game for is to see the cool things that can happen that they have imagined. You know, like the whole the sailing around the undersea aspect of the game. It's just the obstacle between you and the next cool story moment. And I've thought the same thing. Like, what if there was a version where you just clicked a few times and you were on to the next cool story moment? And I think the reason that that's not the way the game is played is because then you would just devour it all in 5 or 10 hours and be done and move on. And then you wouldn't really,
yeah,
you know, the gating of having to sail from here to there. Once you figure out how to keep that alive, right? Like, the whole roguelike aspect of understanding the loops and systems here, it can be tough to wrap your head around that at first, but I only lost once, right? And the rest of the time that I've spent has just been, how long is it going to take me to get from here to there, and from there to there, and from there to there, and then see the cool stuff that I want to see, right? Like, there's no real challenge anymore. I always know I'm going to be able to get away from the danger. I know, yeah, I'm not going to make the wrong calculations on how much fuel to bring with me to see the next cool thing. But the reason I've played like maybe 60 hours of this game now is because I want to see the next cool thing. It's always that cool. So
yeah, I think the gameplay like loop is where it's at. The gameplay itself is like, Liam came in here, you know, my 10-year-old son, and he sat down because he saw that I was playing something. And after about 10 minutes, he was like, so is this it? Do you just move around this map like really slowly?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, that's pretty much it. And then he sat there for like another 45 minutes just watching.
Uh-huh.
And he was kind of like, this is boring. And then he just sat here watching and reading.
Yes. And I had a drunk friend over who watched Game of Thrones with me, and then like before he got picked up to go home, he saw that I was going to play this thing, and he said, "Hey man, I mean, my ride's not here for a while. Can I just watch this?" And I explained to him, "It's pretty slow paced. Like, you need to know what you're getting into before you commit to sitting here and watching 20 or 30 minutes of this game." And he was enthralled with what was going on, right? Like, when I explained, "Here's an officer." The best way to explain this game to someone who like, he's played a ton of console games, so he's familiar with that whole breadth and depth, basically. And he didn't really have any frame of reference for a roguelike story-driven game. But when I said, imagine that you're having a bunch of Mass Effect narrative-style moments, like, you know, separated by the time that it takes to sail from here to there and accomplish a bunch of goals, like, it clicked for him. I could see the light bulb flash. And then I explained two or three of the different little mini storylines that I had been progressing through. Like, here's this officer that he has all these weird sigils drawn on his face, and he doesn't understand why he can't remember why he has them. So I'm going to go all these different places.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the sigil-ridden navigator, right? Yep. Imagine that you're playing Mass Effect and you're going through all of your companions' quests. You know, you can do that with all the officers you can recruit in this game. So I just explained that one from front to back because I had already accomplished it, and I decided on this run, I'm going to accomplish it in a different way and see how it plays out. He was, like, flabbergasted. This game that you got on Steam that looks like it was made in, you know, 2002 at the very latest, they've got that in there? Because it's not about the game, you know, it's about what you're doing in the game. So, I don't know. I like, that's so motivating for me, but I also wonder, would I enjoy it more or less the same if I could just warp from one port to another?
Yeah, one of the things that you told me before I actually bought it was that you weren't sure if, you know, I had the time to necessarily play it, and I kind of agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm glad that I bought it because I've had fun with it, but I've only put in like, you know, 5 hours or so. I'm definitely at the point where I wish that I could do that. I could just kind of see the game as opposed to troll around the, you know, from island to island in the undersea and like shoot at giant crabs. You know, like, that part of the game is just not super rewarding for me
or for anyone. I would argue
it's ridiculously dangerous. I've got no idea how you manage to play this game without, you know, like, only having lost one captain. I lost five captains because every time that I ran into a swarm of bats, I kept on thinking that I was going to kill them. And you can kill them, but just then, as soon as you do that, you pretty much sunk yourself because they sap away so many supplies.
I hate to break it to you on the air live, but you're just a filthy casual, and we've known this about you for a long time. But
gotcha.
That's why you need to get good.
Gotcha.
but no, you. I mean, you told me that the reason that you find yourself dying is because you're impatient, right? And it's right. Like, I don't want to run away and take the long way around and have another 90 seconds or so between me and the next port where something interesting might happen. Or, God forbid, you know, another 3 or 4 minutes because I don't have the fuel to take the long way and I have to go back somewhere that I can afford it or whatever. So, I mean, I totally get it, right? And, Michael, I'm not surprised that you're experiencing what I was worried you might experience, right? Like, I can't remember who I'm quoting from Rock, Paper, Shotgun, but someone recently spoke about the fact that Sunless Sea has a sequel coming out that Failbetter Games kickstarted recently called Sunless Skies. In this game, I think Fallen London has taken to the stars, and it's still like steam-driven starships or whatever, but...
Right, and it's like the moons of Jupiter or something like that are the... Are the new islands.
Oh, man, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
This person's take on what was wrong with Sunless Sea, if anything was wrong with it, it's that the movement from place to place is not interesting, but it's not so uninteresting that you can totally zone out, right? And
that's exactly right.
Right, mm-hmm. Like, I want to listen to a podcast, but then I find myself, you know, doing the every 10 seconds maintenance of steering or, like, looking at my fuel count. We're looking at how much food my crew has to eat, and then suddenly, like, oh man, I haven't listened to this podcast because I have to pay just enough attention to this that I can't pay attention to anything else.
Yeah, it's a hard choice to say. Do I want to play like Splatoon 2 or make a little bit more progress in like Zelda, or do I want to spend like 30 minutes on another run around the Untersea? Like, it just...
I think the real take, like, my take here is that the fact that I do that over and over again instead of something else, it's because I enjoy what is out there for me to discover. I enjoy it that much.
I'm telling you guys, it's a real shame that neither of you are baseball fans, because, honestly, so much better than trying to listen to a podcast or trying to... You know, pay attention to something. You need a baseball game going on in the background, because that you can stop paying attention to as much as you want and nothing changes.
Yeah. If my second monitor wasn't broken and, like, ready to go into the dumpster, you know, I'd probably be able to find something that I didn't need to give my full attention to stream or whatever and put on in the background.
It sounds like we don't need to like baseball to put it on while we... We need to find something we don't give a shit about.
I wish you guys were as non-committal about baseball as me. Oh, man. The thing is, I got this game for $6 on the Steam sale, and I didn't realize it ahead of time because I didn't know you had already played it, Jeff. But I was like, I had been orbiting interestedly around this game for a year and a half or so since I first read about it at Rock Paper Shotgun. I would have paid full price if I had known how much I was going to like it, but then all the caveats that we've come up with already, like, I can't deny any of them. It's boring as hell from island to island. It's not interesting at all.
No, but it is a great time waster game. Having it on the iPad is like just as, you know, like, it, there's no real gameplay to it, so like you're not missing out on lacking a good interface. But it is a fantastic like time waster, and it's really interesting when you start to like get involved in a storyline, and it doesn't even matter that you have to take 10 minutes between reading paragraphs of this story while you sail from one end of the ocean to the other.
Yeah, my biggest problem is that every time I start it up, I want to see the progress of Jeff and Dave on their quests, like I did when I would log into Moonbase Alpha.
Oh, right. Yeah, the BBS feel. Like, where are they at?
1995, yeah.
At the terror of spoiling something for one of you or having one of you spoil something for me means that we just don't really talk about it, you know? Wait, like, Jeff and I went in the most vague terms back and forth about the sigil-ridden navigator before we finally realized, oh, we can both talk about this entire quest line. And then we had a great conversation about it. But I know we need to all three of us decide we are well and truly done with everything this game has to offer before we really, like, completely open the can and discuss everything. I recommend it. I don't know. Do you guys recommend it? At the full asking price is like, what, 16, 18 bucks or something?
Yeah, I recommend it. I think it's definitely worth checking out. I've got an 8-hour flight ahead of me, and I'm looking forward to just playing the hell out of it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
It's $18.99 right now on Steam. I am absolutely positive that you can, that if you're just waiting around, it'll come back up on a Steam sale, or GOG will have it, or maybe it'll be in a Humble Bundle or something like that. Like,
yeah, it should be on sale soon.
One thing I'll add is you mentioned it looks like it's from, you know, early 2000s. It plays amazingly on my Mac. So
yeah, all the graphics are basically 2D, right? There may be some 3D going on in there that doesn't look like it is because it's really low poly, but it's functionally 2D if it's not actually 2D.
I'm actually kind of impressed because, like, Fallen London was essentially a text-based game.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they went from something that was, like, mostly story with some, like, static images to this game that actually, I mean, it has action.
Yeah, it looks totally fine, too. I'm not trying to dunk on it or anything. It looks fine. I mean, you're not there to see, like, a fully realized 3D steampunk ocean battle. That's not why you sign up for this game.
But it's super atmospheric. Like, they did a great job with the tools that they had of capturing this, like, eerie sort of trek through this underground ocean.
The music is fine. The sort of cartoony art style is dark enough that it works well with the theme. It is perfectly fine for what it is. Just as long as you're, you know, if you're looking for, like, a steampunk naval battle game, this isn't it, but nothing, not, that game has not yet been created.
It's actually called, what is it called? There's this game where you fly around in airships and have, like, airship naval battles where it's 4-on-4 online multiplayer and one person has to pilot the ship and then the other three are constantly running around repairing it. Why can't I remember what this is called? It's in my Steam account.
Yeah, they've actually made a few things, like, based off of it, or maybe, like, copies of it. I know what you're talking about, though. But yeah, that's I'll wait for you to come up with the name of the game. But it's that's a fun little game. But it is
Guns
not
Guns of Icarus Online. That's what it's
Guns
called.
Guns of Icarus. Yeah,
I played the hell out of that when it was, like, first released. It might have still been early access. It was a lot of fun, especially if you really had a crew of four people that you knew and had on voice comms. Man, it was a blast. So that game exists.
I played it a few times with some friends, but like, I was getting into it, I feel, as the first surge of player base sort of died off. And so it quickly went, like, the first two games that I played with it were tons of fun, and then the next weekend I wanted to play again, and the few people remaining on the servers were all way too good to play with me.
Right, just brutal aces at the game at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Michael and I both agree that, right, like, the feeling of what it must be like for your sailors to, like, sail into a fog bank and suddenly be terrified that they don't know what's ahead of them, or maybe they roll into some snow and suddenly it's, like, slowing your ship down and you have to work extra hard and you're worried that you might make it back too slowly because your ship can't go full speed, right? Like, that's communicated.
Well, there's no real worry about that because you can just eat a few sailors if you run out of food. Yeah.
But I do disagree with you when you said the music is fine. The music is amazing.
It's amazing.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Like, the sound design is just top notch.
It's really, really good. They absolutely swung above their weight with everything that you listen to from this game. The soundtrack is off the charts good, and you can definitely find all of it on YouTube. So even if you don't buy this game, go put this on the next time you play Call of Cthulhu or something.
Yeah.
Well, I've recently been playing Pyre, which is by Supergiant Games.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've played anything by Supergiant Games. They've only done, like, two other games, Bastion and then Transistor.
Right.
But You want good aesthetics for a game.
You
can't measure anyone against Supergiant, though, right?
Like, they have They have the best music, the best voice acting, the best the best images. Yeah. So, sorry, the music is better than fine. It's just comparatively.
Okay, sure. I mean, when I stand next to Mount Everest, I look small too. I get it. should we talk about Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective? That is allegedly why we're here, right?
Oh yeah.
So before I explain how this game is played, Jeff, you said you were going to take a crack at telling us the publishing and publishing rights history of Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, right?
You got it. This should be fun.
It's not that complicated, right? If you just go step by step, like my group text version of it was only a page and a half long.
So this is a game that was initially published in 1981 by Sleuth Games.
I thought it was ChessX.
Well, maybe I'm wrong.
Are we already wrong? That's step one, and there's already confusion.
I could have sworn it was ChessX, because I was like, hey, those are the people who make dice.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you talking about the dice guys?
Maybe ChessX and Sleuth Games were part of the same shop. Who knows?
I mean, I'll say that this was 1981, so the chances are that like the people who designed it, the three individuals, they just like photocopied it and passed it out at conventions, and they were Sleuth Games or whatever.
That's totally possible.
It's entirely possible. And this game originally came out as photocopied sheets that you would buy the game, and the game was a big brown three ring binder that said Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, and then you would put in as you purchased photocopied sheets with three hole punches in them. You'd put in more sheets in order to advance your acquisition of this game.
So it was the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons monstrous manual, like three ring binder hole punched page expansion model.
Yes, that's awesome. This was big during the 80s because that was the way that you suddenly took something that was a bound thing. You know, the original Dungeons and Dragons monstrous manual. You know, you bought that and that was done. But now you could add to it by subscribing to a service or something like that.
So make sure you buy lots and lots of those little like sticky donuts that you can put on.
Yes. Because God knows you're gonna
in those holes.
You're gonna tear the three ring binder pages about orcs at some point. So as Dave said, many many years pass, and the children of the desert tell tales of the before times.
You're consulting my primary source document from an hour and a half ago.
I really like the way that you phrased that. In the mid 80s, 1985, a French company called Istari started publishing it. Presumably, they bought the rights to the game because they re-released all of the initial stories that had been released by the Sleuth Games guys, or maybe the ChessX guys. I don't know. But that's the 1985 version is the original version that people who have long been familiar with this game probably know as this is Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective.
According to Board Game Geek, in 1985, it was a Spiel des Jahres winner. I didn't know that until I just scrolled down at Board Game Geek.
Yes.
So in
that was
theory,
like that was also like the seventh Spiel des Jahres. So
no way. Okay.
Yeah.
So in theory, then, what you've told me now is that the Raymond Edwards, Suzanne Goldberg, Gary Grady, after having run the convention scene and handing out three hole punched pages, they like finally got paid and got out in like 84 or 85. And Atari owned the property.
And they retired.
They retired on the multiple hundreds of dollars that I'm sure that Atari paid them.
They got sent to a fan fiction farm in upstate New York. Okay.
And they're designing board games there to this day. And chasing farm animals.
So Astari is a French company who published this game, and this is the copy that that Michael owns that we played. And Astari, as a French company, of course, gave zero. Are we swearing on this podcast?
You could just say F's.
They had no F's to give about the English language, and so did not do any sort of copy editing on it. They published this game for the next 30 years. 30 years.
I'm old.
Yeah, we're old. And this is the version that up until very recently, that was the one that you could buy if you spoke English. They translated it into French. It's since been translated into several other languages. I know German. I believe that it's also been translated into Portuguese, Spanish, and Russian, maybe. But I would imagine that the French translation is probably pretty good, and I would question strongly whether or not any of those other languages are any better than the English translation. Which is a real problem because this is a massively text-based game. Yeah. As a matter of fact, this is complete text. There are no dice involved in this game. There are no meeples. There's no board. All it is a bunch of stuff to read.
So, am I crazy though? That like I swear I read somewhere in my last. We've been playing this for now like 3 weeks or so, and I feel like at some point I Googled the game because I was irritated with some typos. We've all three of us done that for sure. We'll get there. But I'm pretty sure I saw someone say that we were playing like an original case, the edition that we have, published by Astari in English, but translated from French almost certainly, like maybe somewhat poorly, but also maybe translated from English to French back to English over the 30 years that they've owned the license?
That's what it seems like.
Yes.
We don't know for sure that that's true, but it seems like it, doesn't it?
I mean, to me, it honestly seems, and I think that Michael actually suggested this first, that this was like an OCR, a very poorly done early OCR scanning job of the original three-hole punch page, just because there's tons of times where crates gets translated into galates or something along those lines.
Pancakes. Yes.
So then what did we actually have our hands on right now, right? Like what Michael has is like the base game published in 2010X, right? It was like 13, 14, or 15 or something. And that
they might have made new editions of it, but Astari has been publishing this game regularly from 1985. They released the new edition that Michael has in 2010, I believe.
Okay. That's right.
So it's not like a crazy old edition as far as like the release update, but that translation may be the same flawed translation that American players or English speaking players have been using for decades now.
I think the way that this worked is that the game was originally created here, and then like most games, it caught on in Europe, and that's that. Like Astari got a hold of it at that point and just kind of ran with it, and then it just fell out of favor here, and no one was interested in publishing it over here.
Okay, so the fact that it's now coming from them, the English language version, is mainly because whoever may have been on top of it in America just wasn't anymore.
Yeah, and you know, we're probably getting a lot of this stuff wrong simply because it's a super niche board game. Well, it's not even a board game because there's no board.
Right.
But it's a game that, you know, probably isn't super popular. I think like 580 people have liked it on BoardGameGeek.
Seriously?
And
I need to go do that. I feel guilty now.
And there's just like there's a lot of history to it, and there's a lot of places where people can get that history wrong. So who knows, really?
I just realized we've been talking this long about the publishing history and haven't actually explained what it is. I didn't realize how long this was going to take.
Well, here, let me just quickly finishing up the publishing history. In 2014, I think it was, Asmodee, who is the French board game publishing giant, who is now bought up every single board game company. Almost all of them. I mean, like, there's still like a few indies, but like all of the major board game companies have been most of them have been consolidated under Asmodee. So when you buy Ticket to Ride, or you buy Settlers of Catan, or you buy Stone Age, or whatever you're buying, no matter what the label on the side of it, Asmodee probably actually owns it. Asmodee purchased Istari, or Istari's parent company at the time, and they're now re-releasing it. They re-released the Thames Mysteries, which was a collection of the first 10 cases in 2015. And then earlier this year, 2017, they released a second set of 10 cases. This is the Jack the Ripper cases, and then six other sort of assorted cases also dealing with the east side of London. At the end of the year, they're apparently promising on releasing a third collection of games for it.
Is it Asmodee or is it Yasmodee? Is it, because they sound like the Ubisoft of the board game publishing world. Is it Ubisoft or Ubisoft?
It's Yasmodee. Actually, the publisher of the most recent version is Space Cowboys. Space Cowboys, pretty sure, is owned by Asmodee, but
well, yeah, you explained this to me the other day, Jeff. I don't know how I somehow didn't know that, like, the Monsanto of the board game publishing world, right? They, like, no matter what imprint you see on a board game, there's a decent chance that they actually own it.
Right. Yeah. The Cool Mini or not is not owned by them, and I don't know any other major board game publishing company that actually is not somehow linked in with them.
I'm just waiting for
Rio Grande is not owned by them.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I thought they were.
Sorry. I'm waiting for Chris Kirkman to tell us that he got bought out by Asmodee so we can all go out and get wasted.
Yeah, I was going to say, we will know that when he starts buying steaks.
Congrats!
Yeah.
Asmodee, if you're listening, check out Dice Hate Me Games.
No. Check out Dice Hate Me Games, who is now owned by Greater Than Games.
Check out Greater Than Games. That's right. You got to start at the top, yeah. And then you'll start at the top from the top down. So, what is this game? I didn't realize, but I should have, that we were going to take this long before we explained it. It's not a board game, as both Jeff and Michael said. It's not even like a role playing game, because you're not like looking at a sheet of a character that you are embodying. That, or even imagining one specific character that you are playing the role of. You're just trying to solve a mystery in a Holmes-like fashion by taking the information that is presented to you, making some deductive leaps, following up on some leads to confirm your guesses or find new information, and then eventually making a jump between here is what I know and can assume to be true, and then I'm figuring out what actually happened. And, mechanically, what you do is sit down as a group, and you're pretending to be the Baker Street Irregulars. Jeff, please stay on point here and correct me if I make any Holmes-related mistakes, because
you know I'm going to interrupt you if you make any sort of mistakes.
You are the Conan Doyle representative of the group here, right?
I'm just an uncorrectable pedant. That's all that matters.
That is the best way I've ever heard you described, and you just did it. You're an uncorrectable pedant. I wish I could time travel back to ninth grade and say, listen, Dave, it's going to be way easier to be friends with Jeff if you just think of him as an uncorrectable pedant. You guys are going to get along way better.
it's never too late.
You really did just enhance our relationship. Well done, sir.
We're always growing as friends.
So in the Holmes universe, the Baker Street Irregulars are just a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, presumed to be like teenaged, right? Who do the bidding of Holmes. Like, I need you to go just watch this place and see if this guy leaves work and goes and talks to anybody shady looking, right? You would imagine that the Baker Street Irregulars are the ones doing that.
I need you to go get my cocaine.
Right. Kind of headed up by an M period Wiggins, right? Is the sort of leader of the Baker Street Irregulars. So in the game, mechanically, what you do is get an intro for a mystery. Hey, a murder happened. I think that in all five cases that we've done of the 10 in the box that Michael bought, it's a murder that you're trying to solve. I just assume it's a death or a murder in every one, probably, but Here's what happened. Here's what we know. Here's what the person coming to Holmes for help knows and, you know, thinks he should go look into. Okay, Holmes is off. He's going to go solve the case in the most unbelievably efficient way possible, as he often did in the stories. You, as the Baker Street Irregulars, have all this information. You have, like, a bunch of potential plot threads you can follow to try to figure out what's actually going on. What you do mechanically is you look at a map of London and a directory of London locations, and if you think that they're relevant to your investigation, you look at the address that you want to visit, and then you consult a booklet for your particular case, like, say, case one. You're going to go look at, you know, 10 West Central London. And then if something relevant to the case happens, or like happened or is related to 10 West Central London, then in your little case book, there's going to be some information that plays out, like, what would the Baker Street Irregulars see and talk about and do when they went to 10 West Central London. So maybe Wiggins goes into the hotel and says, "Hey, you're the bellhop. We heard you were on duty the night that this guy was killed at this hotel. Can you tell us about that?" And if that's something that the bellhop would tell the Baker Street Irregulars, then you, as the group playing the game, get to read that little entry. So you follow as many leads as you think you need to, keeping track of how many actual individual leads that you follow. And through the course of the investigation, you know, after going to 10 West Central London, it may be clear that you need to go to a restaurant in East London. But you didn't know about that at first, so you're following this thread, you know, like the person coming to Holmes had no idea that this restaurant was relevant, but you following these leads, now you do. You're taking note of all the places that you go to try to solve all the questions about what actually happened. Then you decide as a group, okay, we're ready. We're pretty sure that we've got this figured out. We're going to flip to the end of the casebook. And then there's going to be some questions there, some primary questions like, why was this person killed? Who did it? Why was the blank the murder weapon or whatever? And then there's some secondary questions like this other person that you may have come across in the course of this investigation. Why did they have blank happen to them? Whatever. The book says there's so many points awarded for correctly answering each of these questions. And then you compare the number of leads that you followed before you decided to answer those questions to how many Holmes followed. And his number is going to be something insane, like 4. He only needed 4 leads to solve the entire case.
And maybe you needed 35.
Yeah, maybe you went 35 places. So how many more leads did you go on? Did you follow up than Holmes? 5 points for each of those, and then knock those off of your final score. Holmes always scores 100 points. And then you take the points that you scored, subtract 5 for each extra lead, and then that's your score. So mechanically, that's it, right? I didn't really miss anything?
It's basically a super complex, very difficult choose your own adventure that you do with preferably that you do with other people.
Very well written choose your own adventure as well. Like this, you know, it's all of the cases that I've gone through really have felt like once you get past some of the problems that I think that we're going to get into, all feel like not really very good Sherlock Holmes fan fiction. Like you're really getting, the stories, they seem real. There actually is like these logical connections between all of these things. Occasionally you get,
usually you
don't get sent down too many wrong roads. And oftentimes if you do, you can just sort of like look back at yourself and say that I really need to go 7 places to find out if this guy had a mistress. Like,
let me hop in, by the way, and say before anyone worries, no spoilers here. Okay. We're going to do the outro of the show. We're going to tell you to like us on Facebook and subscribe on iTunes and all that. Then you're going to hear the outro music. And after that, we're going to get into spoilers. So if you were thinking about buying this game and you have not played any of it, just cut the podcast off right there and come listen to it weeks from now once you're done through Case 5. The 3 of us have played through Case 5 in the base box of the game, and we're going to discuss spoilers then after the show. But for right now, we're going to be very general while we keep talking about it. Sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
Right. Well, like I said, I mean, there are, you know, in every single case, there are things that you don't have to do. And as a matter of fact, that's actually, we sort of figured out after having completed the first 2 cases that there are 2 paths that you can go on, and we call them the Holmes path and the Watson path. Right, Michael?
Yep.
So you were the one that...
No, I think Dave actually coined that.
No, it was you, Jeff. It was you.
Oh, it was? Well,
I think it was me, actually.
I think it was Michael, the guy on the screen whose name I don't know that I saw 3 hours ago.
Michael, why don't you explain the difference between the Holmes path and the Michael path? The Holmes path and the Watson path.
Well, thanks.
The Jeff path and the Michael path. And by that, I mean...
The team player normal person path and the incorrectable pedant path.
I mean, yeah.
I don't know if those are one-to-one analogies.
The Holmes path is the like leaps of unquestionably good logic, right? He just like he makes these assumptions based on facts usually, and he's able to solve the cases with just like checking four different places. The Watson path is we're gonna go to the scene of the crime, and then we're gonna go check in on all of the relatives of the victim. We're gonna question everybody. Maybe we're gonna make a visit to Mycroft Holmes and ask him a question. We're gonna swing back by Scotland Yard, see if see if Lestrade has anything to add. We're gonna go all over the place. We're gonna take our time. And we're going to be sure about this before we finger our suspect.
And to be noted, you can read every single entry in one of these case books, and you don't. There's no the murderer never confesses to you.
There's never going to be an entry where you see a smoking gun in the hand of the actual murderer in a photograph, right? Like it's never just going to say this guy did it.
Right. Well, except in case five.
I don't know which one it was, honestly, but there was one where it was pretty obvious, right?
Yeah,
I can't really remember. Yeah.
It was in case five. That's for sure.
Well, we'll get there. Specific spoilers. Yeah. Remember after you hear the outro music.
But yeah, I mean the fact of the matter is that you have to at some point make a logical kind of deduction of who did what, and you have to, you don't have those questions before you flip to them, or at least we didn't. I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to flip to them before you've finished like your investigation.
No, I'm totally sure that is definitely how you're supposed to play it. Because if you knew the four primary questions it was going to ask you, then you'd have a heads up even on Holmes, right? Like the way that once you've answered the questions correct or incorrect, you're going to read an outro to the case where Holmes and Watson and the Baker Street Irregulars are all in, like, we're all, like, holed up in a room somewhere, maybe at 221B Baker Street, and Watson's like, what the hell actually happened here? I don't understand, as you would, see at the end of an actual Holmes story. And he goes, well, elementary, let me explain it to you. And you get Holmes's summary of the events of the case. Not only the summary, but also the summary of his deductive reasoning leaps. And
yeah, what a jerk.
Right? Right?
I mean, God, it's what? Just like even if you do the Watson path and you like literally go to, though that's the other thing I don't think you mentioned, but like, there are thousands of places you could potentially go based on this directory of London. And they've picked maybe like 30 of them to go into the case file. So if you're like really dumb or really bad, you might visit a place that's not even in the case book.
But that doesn't count against you.
It doesn't count against you. But still, like, you can totally do that. And we did that.
Let's be clear. First of all, there are, like, several hundred locations in the directory and on the map, I want to say. Not thousands. But still, you're right. If you're completely dumb and making a bunch of dumb decisions, you're just going to say, hey, that place, that building right there, that was near where that guy got killed. Let's go there. And then there's not even anything in the casebook at all, right? So that's wasted time. Then there's also the moments where you either foolishly or forgivably follow like a potential logic chain to where you say, all right, well, there must be some more relevant information at this location for these reasons, whatever they are. And you go there and the book says, you screwed up. And the way that you know you screwed up is that no one answers the door for 5 minutes. And then someone comes here and says, no, James Harding didn't live here. That's John Harding. You got the wrong J. Harding. You effed up.
Yeah.
And then you as the players are like, well, damn, dude, we just messed up by not looking in the directory correctly. But we have to mark that down as a visit that our group took.
Yeah, Jeff, you mentioned earlier that you didn't feel like the game, like, you know, carried you down wrong paths terribly.
But it
delights in taking you down the wrong paths, and it rubs your nose in those wrong paths.
It definitely does. There's at some point or other where you're going. You can, if you want to, you can go to some pharmacies, and the pharmacies lead you in a big circle.
No spoilers.
Yeah, you can. You're also going to do that. You can do that with tobacconist. You can do that. I mean, we actually went through, and I don't even remember which case this was, but there was one case where there was something that seemed to be vaguely something that might have been related to the case, and we went to like all six of the department stores or something like that that were in the directory, and none of them were in the case, because it was so far left field. When there's a red herring that you can start going down, yeah, sometimes the authors do enjoy dropping your score by 30 points for presuming that you're going to get an answer that Wiggins can't drum up.
I mean, like, at times though, you've just made that mistake because you've accidentally assigned too much value to this thread, right? Like, what you don't know and what would spoil your understanding of what to do is what those questions are going to be at the end of the case book. So if you don't know, like, okay, let's say there's a diamond necklace or something that's, we think, is central to the motivator, to the motive for this murder, we're going to go figure out what's up with this diamond necklace. We're going to go talk to some experts about necklaces and jewelry, and we're going to see who owned this today, who owned it a month ago, who made it. But maybe you flip to the end of the book, and the diamond necklace is a secondary question worth 10 points. Like, who has the diamond necklace now? You're like, no, we just wasted like 8 or 10 lead follow-ups costing us 40 or 50 points to follow up on this diamond necklace, but it turned out that had nothing to do with the case, not really, right? And yeah, Holmes just makes the right calls. He sees the diamond necklace as a red herring, so he doesn't need to worry about those extra points that they throw you a bone for, like going to figure out what's up with the necklace.
Yeah, did we even talk about the newspaper?
No, we didn't. Oh god, yeah, there's a newspaper, there's an edition of the London Times associated with every case, and since they're presented to you in chronological order, let's say case one is from March 1888 and case two is from May 1888. In case two, the March 1888 newspaper may also be relevant. And you don't know when you're looking at the newspaper before you get the intro to the case what's relevant from this newspaper. It's just a front and back, like, you know, giant size sheet of paper with maybe, you know, it's got like three columns of articles, and here's some births and marriages and deaths, and here's some steamship departures, and here's some stuff that's going on. Like, if you want to go check out London Entertainments, and here's some letters to the editor. If you just gloss over it before you start the case, you don't know what's important. But as you're progressing in the case, randomly, some little snippets from the newspaper will turn out to be, like, absolutely vital.
As a matter of fact, depending on the case, you don't even really have to go to very, very many places. You can solve half the case just by following the path of something's through the newspapers.
Yeah, at times, true.
At London Times, even.
I quit. I'm out.
It's just the Times. It's not the London Times. It's just the Times.
You're right. Okay, it is actually titled The Times. You're right.
All right, so we'll just forget that I said that then.
Let's forget that Jeff is an incorrigible bit. I can't. I can never forget now.
It's not going to happen now.
It's one of your most adorable qualities. Let's be honest, though.
So yeah, just to go back to that point, like, even if you Watson the hell out of this thing, you're going to get to the end, and you're still going to have to make some sort of a jump. And God, man, like, if you visit every single location, which, you know, means that they tend to subtract like between. Is it always like 5 points?
Always, yeah, it's always 5 points. Lead.
Yeah, yeah, so you visit 30 places, you're subtracting subtracting an absurd amount of points compared to Holmes's 100, and you still don't know for sure anything.
True. Yeah. I mean, you can, right? We've had several different degrees of experience playing this game. which I guess that's something else we haven't explained yet. What it actually feels like to play this game in a group is awesome, right? If you feel like you're onto something, then, you know, following up that first lead, let's say we agree as a group, or we take turns deciding which lead to follow up. Let's say we go to the scene of the crime and we hear some in-person interview stuff from people that work at wherever this murder happened. Then you set down the casebook. Maybe you're taking notes about what you feel like is important on the murder victim and your, you know, potential murderers and why they might have done it and who else is involved and what's going on. And then you're batting around these ideas like, okay, well, based on what we know, here's what might have actually happened, and here's some places that we can go to follow up on it, and where should we go next? What's going to be the most valuable thing? Like, all of this discussion that happens in between reading out of the book, like, that's the game. And when that's going well, it's so awesome. It's really, really cool when that's going well. It's like the times that it's not that are frustrating.
So there is always the cheat of going and talking to Holmes about the case, right?
True. Yeah, the back of the rule book has like a bunch of Holmesian contacts. Like, here's the coroner, and it's the guy from the Holmes novels, and here's the guy that is in touch with criminal underground contacts at the Raven and Rat Tavern, and here's the criminologist, and here's Lestrade, who works at Scotland Yard. Right? There's all these people you can go for sort of hints if you don't know where to go next. And Holmes is the ultimate hint giver. If you just go to Holmes right away, he'll be like, well, it's cute that you don't know what to do. If I was you, I would start here.
So as a as my advice to anyone starting to play the game, I would never go to Holmes first, because all you're going to be doing is losing 5 points and then being given you're usually pretty much given exactly what Holmes is going to do. And so you lose on it. But if you get to that point where you're just feeling completely frustrated, you can go to Holmes and you can see like, oh, well, I've done everything except for I haven't gone to the docks yet. And Holmes says that maybe I should go to the docks. And so that's going to maybe open up. Oh, well, now I can find the motive out.
I kind of disagree. I think from a, and this raises a really interesting question. I think from a pure, like, we want to beat Holmes. So we want to go to as few places as possible. I kind of feel like going to Holmes first might help you in that situation.
Sure, but you're never going to beat Holmes if you go and talk to him.
Right? Well, yeah.
Because then, you know, best case scenario, he'll tell you, I'm going to go to 3 places and I'm going to look through the newspaper. And now you're going to have gone to 4 places and looked through the newspaper because you had to talk to me.
Okay, well, so that opens up another kind of point, which is we never even came freaking close to beating Holmes.
We came close. We scored 70 in one game, which was...
Yeah, but that's... Okay, that's still 30 points away from Holmes. And what I'm saying is that if we had potentially gone to him first in that particular run, he may have set us up better and we could have gotten like a 90. And
right.
And all of this is leading me to the point where I don't really care what my score is in this game. Like, I don't care about beating Holmes. I just care about, like, doing as well as I can. Because right. I almost feel like the Watson path through the game is more fun than trying to just do, like, go to four locations.
That's an important question to answer for your group, right? Like, do we feel like we want to measure up against the master deductor, or do we just want to head into the end game, like flip to the back of the book and answer those questions as sure as possible that we know everything that happened, right? And I think we've had both experiences as a group of the three of us. We've had both of those experiences, right, where we knew that we knew. And then we had one where we went to very few places and we were pretty sure that we knew. And we enjoyed both of those experiences, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've enjoyed this game every time I've played it, except for when I played it by myself.
Right. Yeah, we've also run the negative gamut, I want to say, right? Like, the three cases that I felt like I wasn't really sure what happened, I experienced one where it turns out, yeah, we sure had no idea what happened. And there was one where we weren't sure if we were going to be able to answer enough questions. But we did. We got a decent score, you know, and we actually did know what had happened. And then playing solo, I just flip to the end. I'm like, man, I'm going to have to guess on some of this. So I've had every experience that felt bad and every experience that felt good, right? I think I've, out of the five cases that I've played myself, I've basically had every possible outcome.
So there actually is an alternate to the way that that the game normally plays from the cases that we've gone through, which is so I played one of the Jack the Ripper cases with my dad this past week, and the Jack the Ripper cases are set up a little bit differently, wherein you have 15 leads and you don't lose any points for using up all 15 of those leads. If you have to go to a 16th place, you just lose the game. I mean, like, you can't go to a 16th place.
At the 16th place, Jack the Ripper kills you.
but that provides its own, like, it's a different way that this the same setup for this game can work. And it allows you to be as Watson-y as possible. Just knowing that, you know, like, when you start getting down to lead 13 or so, you're going to have to stop following up this sort of thread that you're going on, because you really need to figure out, a little bit more information about the main case.
I think what we're saying here, basically, a bunch of different ways, is that your group can potentially enjoy this game in a very unique way, in a way that other groups didn't specifically enjoy it. But there's a lot of ways to enjoy this game. At least that's where I came out after five cases.
I think that if your group enjoys going through, like, the loop of you've been sent down a red herring path, and suddenly when you get pointed back towards your first the first place you went to, you realize that the writer has been playing a game with you, and it's aggravating, but that I feel like that can be enjoyable in its own sense. You're just like, oh my gosh, look what this guy has done to me.
Right.
That's its own bit of fun, and I don't think that's a terrible thing to have, as long as your group is not the group that wants to beat Holmes or wants to do as well as possible. If you're the group that wants to do as well as possible, when you get to your sixth place, you need to just go to the end and start answering questions, because Holmes is never going to take more than six moves.
You hope that you got it at that point, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I'll also add that we talked a lot about kind of the issues with this game's journey to its modern publication. There are some definite, at least in the edition that I played, some definite problems with typos, with things that are left out, issues with I won't say with the map itself, but maybe with reading the map. And when you encounter some of those issues and you kind of discover that they caused you to spend, let's say, an entire case not going to the right place, the place that you should have gone in the very beginning.
Right.
That can be super frustrating.
In one of the cases that I did, Michael, there were some printed out sheets of paper that I suppose were like some online correction, for a case that changed.
Yes. Yeah.
There were two broken wine glasses or one broken wine glass on a floor. And if you've ever read a murder mystery, two broken wine glasses on the floor means an entirely different thing than one broken wine glass.
Yeah.
Like, that changes the whole tenor of what you're looking for in the mystery.
And so I will say, no spoilers here, but that was case three. If you go into Board Game Geek, you will find it's like a no spoilers errata for case three. If you have this particular Istari edition.
The 2010 edition in particular, right?
Yeah, it's like 2010 or I think maybe 2014. But
that's significantly different. That's why I was asking.
I think 2014 was when Asmodee republished it.
Okay, with the Istari like label on the cover.
Yes, they did, and that's the one that I have, is the 2014 one.
2014 but, republishing that says Istari on the box. Okay.
Yep.
Right.
And so you can print those out, and you can put them kind of like I paperclip them over the other pages. But what, you know, one of the issues is that you have this thing where as you're flipping through the case, you know, going to a specific location, you don't want to like use, you don't want to see the other stuff on the pages.
Yes.
You don't want to see that, like, okay, I'm going to 53 West Central, but 51 West Central is also on this page. And, oh, I just noticed that it's really big. So
I don't even
know where that is, but I want to go there next because I know there's a lot to say and there's a lot of information.
It's a bizarrely meta problem that's like super important, right? It's exactly what you just said. You see 51 West Central, you're like, oh man, well now I can't unknow that 51 West Central is super important. So when we as a group say, are we going to go here or here or here or here? I'm going to know that 51 West Central is like potentially the one that cracks the case wide open. And it's too late. I already know it. I can't unknow it.
Yeah. And that's why this game would be... Dave, you mentioned this a number of times. It'd be really cool if there was an app where, you know, you just punch in the location and it pops up the, you know, the thing to read.
Yeah.
And if someone... But, you know, if whoever initially transcribed it made a typo, they could just fix it.
Well, oh, my God. Yeah. This game deserves, like, we're more than unloading both barrels on the problems with it right now, and it deserves every barrel, right? Like, the typo situation is ridiculous. The font that they chose for the booklet that we're reading at this edition is just insane. Why is it all italicized? Why does the C and the L close together and look like a D, like, every time? What the hell is wrong with the publication? It's so frustrating. And why doesn't the rule book tell you up front, hey, sometimes there's not going to be something in the directory, but this is going to be a location you can visit. And you're supposed to deduce from a previous lead follow-up that, hey, at blank street, there's an interesting location. It's not going to be in the directory. But as detectives, you're supposed to figure out, well, even though this is unlisted, it's a place we should go check out because this guy mentioned that on blank street, right? No.
Yep.
Blank street. He said... It's on blank street. And then you're supposed to look at this map. And you're Jeff, you're saying we used modern day Google Maps to figure out where we're supposed to go. Because who wants to look through this insanely detailed map of the London street layout and say, where is blank street? That's insane. Just Google Maps where blank street is and then look at the map. It's so frustrating that you're not told ahead of time, hey, this is a method of delivering information you can follow up on that you should look out for. So we got to the end of that case, and we had gone on like 15 or 20 extra leads where we probably could have gotten that info if we had just known. It's not in the directory, but hey, it's in the book. It's so frustrating.
Yeah, there is a way to figure out where it is, and we'll get into this when we do the post-ending spoiler talk. But there is a way that it suggests that you then know from then on out, if you know something or other about the address, you can sort of boil it down. But
it's not clear.
It is not clear at all. There's no way that anyone approaching the game for the first time would be able to determine these things unless they were just crazy autistic, combing through every single detail in the newspapers or every single street name on a very detailed map of, we're not just talking central London. I mean, like, we're getting into like South.
There's 100 streets. There's at least 100, right?
Easily.
And it's not okay though. Like, it's too late. The reason I'm so mad about that first case experience that we had is that in a game where the entire experience is going from the front half of the case, not knowing, to the end of the case, knowing, it's too late. I can't go back and re-experience that with the understanding that I might see a street in the casebook, you know, from like witness testimony, and then know to go look at the map and discover something that's not in the separate London directory. It's too late. Case one is ruined because I know case one now.
With a game that is entirely based on text, you have to make sure that the text is accurate everywhere. And I get that there's a lot of it. There's a ton of text. It makes it hard to copy edit, but they really made some bad choices and they missed some major typos, and it just kind of smacks of, you know, lack of time or whatever.
But the flip side there is that at the end of case one, I was still really excited to go to the end and know everything because we got done with case one and we had it cold, man. We answered like almost every single question. We got all the primary questions, right? We knew absolutely without a doubt who killed that dude and why and, you know, what was going on before and after. We totally understood what was up. But we, like, the experience of getting there got soured at the end of our investigation.
And we got 0 points.
We got exactly 0 points. We scored, like, all of the points. And then after we took away how many leads Holmes needed to follow up, we took 120, and we had gone to 24 extra locations, and we subtracted 120 points. It was so weird. That night felt like a very representative emotional roller coaster of your experience that's possible with this game, right? We went in, we had no idea whether we were going to enjoy it or not, but we were hopeful. And then in the middle of the investigation, we were super excited because we felt like we were making progress. And then we thought, hey, why don't we understand where we're supposed to go? It's not in the directory. Well, let's go these other 15 places. And we got really discouraged. And then we figured out, oh, it's there. And we can go, even though it's not in the directory. And then we got, like, encouraged again because we totally knew that we were right. All of our suspicions were correct. We got to the end. We answered the questions. We were super high on ourselves. Yes, that's awesome. We crushed it. Oh, wait, we got 0 points. That's kind of disappointing. And also, if we hadn't gone those 15 extra places because we ended up 15 leads later figuring out we could go to this location X, not in the directory, and just confirm our 15 leads ago suspicions, oh, we would have scored like 70 or 80 points. It was such a weird experience playing this game.
I will say I've learned how to take notes for the game.
Yes.
Like the first time we played, it was just kind of like stream of consciousness, you know, filled in a page, moved to the next page. But man, by case five, I had a method down. I was like, page one is for locations. Page two is for suspects. Page three is, you know, is for the pathway that we're taking. And I got really good at taking notes.
And it's fun to play a role, right? Like, if you're the directory guy, it's fun to be the directory guy. Like, hey, Jeff, have you written down all the clothiers in London? Do you know where the four places we can go? All right, Jeff's the directory guy.
Yeah. Although, I've got to say, doing it solo, there was an 8-year-old at the beach house that I was at this past week that I was playing one of these cases solo, who walked past me and looked at me and said, "Why are you doing homework?"
that's totally great.
I've got all these sources like sprawled out all over the table, and I'm like carefully writing, you know, like I'm on my fifth page of paper that I've got stuff. I'm consulting things. Yeah, it's absolutely taking doing homework, which is why I would so. Before we make like, you know, like hard recommendations about this game, I would heartily recommend against playing this game solo.
Yes, you're right. The rulebook suggests you could play it individually and try to like compare your score with the other people you know who are also playing a case individually. I did not enjoy that at all.
Nah.
I think the problem is that it takes a table, like a whole friggin' room full of intelligent people making one deductive leap per person to possibly match the 10 deductive leaps that Holmes is going to make on his own. You just can't keep up, right? I was so dejected when I flipped to the end of case number 5, having played it solo, just going like, oh man, I really hope they don't ask me these questions because I don't know, right?
I think we need to get into spoilers.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk spoilers. So
case 5, man. Ugh.
Well, okay, so hard yay or nay, right? The game, I think, is like $30. Isn't that right? It's like 30 or 40. It's not super expensive. So you're talking $3 or $4 per case that a whole room full of people could potentially enjoy from like 2 to 6 hours, depending on how thorough you are and how much time you spend in between following leads discussing it as your group. What do you guys think? I'll go first. I think, hell yeah, right? Even though a few of the experiences that we had of the 5 that I've had now with this game, a few of them were disappointing, you know, somewhat disappointing, and I really got frustrated at the end of case 5. I had a ton of fun at some point during each of those cases, way more than $3 per case or whatever. I think, yes, from me. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, same thing. Case five, doing it by myself afterwards, I actually texted Dave and I was like, I don't think I want to play this anymore. But then I've thought about it a little bit more since then, and I think that this is such a singular experience. It's not like a game that I've played. And I feel like, depending on your group, like, it's not for everyone, for sure. But if you're the type of gaming group who, you know, likes to work together, likes to hear an interesting story, likes to maybe read in terrible British accents, like, you're gonna have a really cool night pulling this game out. So I think it's well worth the money, even if, you know, you have 10 cases, and once you're finished, you're done. It's well worth it.
Well,
yeah, what do you think, Jeff?
You're done, and the nice thing about it is that there's no reason to keep it. You can, you know, it's a great thing to then gift on to you know, like, your cousin in the next state over to possibly play.
Great point. Yeah.
Or just donate it to your local gaming store or your public library.
Yes. What would you say, though? Should people buy this or get their hands on it? Yeah.
Or should they wait for their cousin to finish it?
Well, there's an Asmodee version coming eventually, right?
There already is an Asmodee version of the Thames Mysteries, which are the ones that we've been going through. And I played. I haven't seen those, but I did play through the Asmodee version of the Jack the Ripper cases, and many of the technical issues that we've discussed have been corrected in that. Now, I presume that, you know, some of the case logic problems won't be solved, but even with some of that, I absolutely think that it's worth it. But definitely not the typos and the the we forgot this line that mentioned how many, you know, like, how many bodies were in the room or whatever missing pieces from the original pieces were. The Asmodee versions, I absolutely think you see it. I think it cost me $35 at our local gaming store to buy, and it is totally worth it. When the one comes out this winter, I'm going to buy it then, and we'll play through those ones.
So I think we're all sort of thumbs up on. I think we're all thumbs up on you buying this game, basically. As long as you know going in, your spoiler-free recommendations are understanding. It may not be spelled out in front of you in the book, but it's usually safe to assume, right? Like, they may say that someone was killed and someone else was found with a gun in their hand, and they may never say that that person was actually shot. And you may think, well, this is the way to go. Just assume they were actually shot. Don't waste your brain power on that. It's that kind of thing that gets so frustrating. And if you do get caught up accidentally following this, like, red herring thread that seems like it really matters, and then you realize, oh, it was just poor presentation on the part of the, like, this particular publication of the game, don't lose a whole lot of sleep over it. Just move on past that, you know, take another drink of bourbon, and then you're fine. You're ready to solve the case.
There are also a few spoiler-free guides to playing the game that kind of address some of the hinkiness. And like I said, there's a, like, an errata for case, I think, 3 and case 6.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that helps. Board Game Geek is your friend on this one.
Yeah, look for a spoiler-free guide before you even start playing the game. That's a great idea. It'll tell you a bunch of the stuff that we've sort of, you know, glossed over here and there. Man, we've been talking for a while. So we're going to talk for at least a couple minutes after we're done here, and it'll be spoilerific. So if you don't want to hear about the particulars of Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective Cases 1 through 5, you need to get out of here now. While you're doing that, go and leave us a review on iTunes, etc. Please subscribe, rate, review. Love, send e-hugs, tell your friends. Facebook.com/dissection, dissection.com, dissection everywhere, whatever. We're going to get out of here. We got to go use the bathroom and then come back and talk about the cases. For Michael, for Jeff, it's been The Dissection. I'm Dave. Good night.
Good night, Gov.
And we're back. Okay, we're going to talk spoilers for cases 1 through 5.
Sherlock Moriarty Holmes. Did it. Moriarty did it. It's him.
He didn't do it, but I sure guessed that he did in case 5 because I didn't know any better. Anyway, here, let's do this. Jeff, you go first. Case 1, ready, set, bitch. Let's hear it.
Oh my God. So 12 Deverell Street. 12 motherfucking Deverell Street. So you know that
this
there is...
Yeah, this is rated M for mature from here on out, by the way.
There's this single location, the Armory, that is like supposedly the place you that the murder victim he owned, but he didn't go to, and you're supposed to go find this Armory, and it won't give you a location. There's only one location in the directory. You go there, and that's the murder scene. And where are you supposed to go to find 12 Deverell Street? Well, apparently you're supposed to go look around the entire freaking map for Deverell Street and find a building labeled 12 near it. But it doesn't tell you that. And as a matter of fact, the only thing that would possibly let you know what that there would be any connection between the street number and the numbers on the buildings on the map is the fact that, 221B Baker Street, you would assume that that would be 221, right? Right? No, it's 42 because they made a damn nerd joke.
You're super right. It's so frustrating. It was like the most defeating moment that we've had, I think, playing this game as the three of us, at least, right? Where the fuck is 12 Deverell Street? Who knows? It's supposed to be the Deverell Street Arms Plant. And you look in the directory and the like arms company doesn't have a friggin' address in the directory. Okay, well, knowing what we know about the way that this game is played, then that's apparently not a place you need to go. There must not be any information there because there's no heads up anywhere in the book that says, hey, just so you know, it's possible that a location on this map that's not listed in the directory might matter. And you might discover that through the course of the investigation. If they had just said that, we would have gotten to the end an hour and a half earlier and way more like confident and happy about ourselves. I mean, again, like I said, you know, before the break here, I really enjoyed case one. I really enjoyed that. But that chunk of time where we were like, man, I wish there was someone to confirm our suspicions about these two specific points. Ugh, it was just so frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, aside from that, case one's fine.
I really liked case one. Okay, case two. That's the case two is the one that we solved in the Holmes method, right? We sat there and discussed a great deal between each lead that we decided to follow up, and we got done. We'd only gone to like 8 leads. We would have actually tied Holmes' score if we had just been able to figure something out. We just didn't, right? We didn't know what the F was up with the Napoleon figurine. The Wellington figurine, right? And we weren't thinking hard enough. Like, the trope in this is that the guy did something right as he died. Of course, the victim leaves, like, a message scrawled in blood on the ground. Did someone write this to taunt us? No, it was the victim. They were leaving us crucial information or whatever. God, it was so frustrating. Like, getting to the end of that and not being 100% done. But then I felt awesome as we turned to the end, right? We had that moment where we looked at each other and we were like, Sword Cane! Sword Cane! We're so smart! Fucking Sword Cane! We felt like total studs. And then we got to the end and we were right about like everything that we knew we were right about. What we didn't know was why did he turn the figurine around? I was only mad after the fact, right? I was ready to go and I was just mad at myself. Well, dang, if we had just thought a little harder, we might have come up with that. But... man, yeah. What do you think about case two, Michael?
That's actually one of the cases that I enjoyed the most. I felt like the one thing that we got wrong that you were just mentioning about the tinged soldier, I didn't feel bad about that at all, and I thought it was kind of cool that it was a piece of information that you don't necessarily. Get out of the case, that you just kind of have to bring that to the table. Isn't that right, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I actually went back through the whole damn case file and just in order to see whether or not it would tell us at some point or other, oh, this, you know, the glass was actually found inside the pommel of the rapier that was being held by the murder victim. So you would know that it wasn't the murderer who did it. There was nothing that actually said that. It definitely could have either been the murder victim or the murderer who turned it around. and you just have to make a decision as to which one of those two were going to do it. And we had a coin flip decision to decide, oh, well, we're going to say that it's the murder victim, or that it was the murderer, not the murder victim. And we had essentially the mirrored explanation as to why he turned it around. But there was no way to figure that out, and we lost 20 points on that.
Yeah, it was disappointing because we did float the idea, right? We were in the very close vicinity of what the actual reasoning was behind why the figurine was turned around, and we just said, "Well, it's that ish, or it's this ish." So let's say it's this ish that the murderer did it for this sort of vague reason, and then we were just wrong. We didn't get it.
Eh, whatever.
Okay, case three. What was case three again?
Case three.
We destroyed case three, right? Michael, you and I and your wife, Natanya, and our friend Brian, the four of us played it. We were really good at case three. I think that may have been my favorite experience so far because we got to the end and we were like really confident. I don't actually have too many complaints about case three, except specifically that it never says to you, yes, this guy was shot. So don't waste your time trying to discover a different method of his death. Right.
But it does. It does tell you that there was a burnt hole. Like there was a gunpowder hole in his shirt. So I don't understand why you guys had that big of a problem with it.
I don't remember that. I specifically remember us poring over all of the descriptions, not finding that. And then I think we ended up going to either the coroner or somebody who told us that it was a gunshot. But
I felt like case three gave you the information in the most reasonable fashion of the three of the five that I've played so far. It was just, the ask was not insane, right? There's some pretty like realistic deductive jumps.
You had to make a really big deductive jump to determine that Trevelyan had snuck in there himself and shot her shot the dude, as opposed to having the woman hypnotized sneak in there and shoot him. You had to connect the dots with that the circus performers said that you wouldn't do something you wouldn't normally do.
There's a couple of things about that case. First of all, that's the case that did have the errata. Second of all, that's a case that in the original edition of the game, Loretta was the killer. And they decided to change it to a different person, I guess, so that you could replay it. I don't know. Like, it makes no sense why you would attempt to take this one case and swap things around. But they did a really crappy job of swapping things around, and they still left a lot of clues pointing you in the direction of Loretta. There are some major issues with the so first of all, like, if Trevelyan snuck into the room, and if I forget the name of the victim,
Calendar.
Yeah, whatever. The victim,
Guy Clarendon.
Clarendon. If Clarendon was sneaking out, you know, to do his little thieving sessions, why did the ivy have dust on it? Why would they mention that? That doesn't make any sense. It's like, if you say that an ivy trellis has dust on it, then the Holmesian conclusion is that it hasn't been used. And that's really obnoxious.
Yeah, you're right. That's actually, and it's only a conclusion that you would come to because that adjective is written on the paper. What if it just wasn't? Then you wouldn't waste any brain power on it,
yeah,
or potentially right, go the opposite direction with your deduction. Yeah.
And the second thing is that, you know, everybody in the hotel heard the gunshot in the morning when what's her name goes in and, you know, is under hypnosis and shoots the ceiling, but no one heard the gunshot in the middle of the night.
Dude, you're right. I forgot that part. That is some grade A bullshit. Oh my God. That's really lame. You're right.
It's also really aggravating that there is a pile of plaster in the middle of the floor, and there is no function. And obviously you can't have a function in the way that this game is set up for you to be able to look at the ceiling. Like, look around for where this plaster came from.
Well, you want, like, the adventure game option to just, like, mouse over, and when the magnifying glass icon pops up, you want to click on the ceiling.
You mean the Sega CD version of this game?
Which there is.
Why did Sierra Online not publish this?
They might have. They might have published that Sega CD version.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, Case 3 is all kinds of messed up now that I kind of remember.
Yeah, but I still feel like I was the most confident after the most reasonable amount of effort in Case 3. Maybe that's just because we happened to put it together, right?
And we had a good group, you know. I mean, we had a good group when we were playing Case 1 and Case 2, but we had one extra person when we were doing Case 3.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just... This game is good in spite of itself.
And yet, Case 4, we still didn't really know what had happened when we got... The three of us plus our friend Chuck didn't really know why. We had figured out what, right? So we knew we were going to get the what questions right. And we even knew for damn sure in Case 4, when they ask, where are the lions now? We're like, well, we found them. We went to the taxidermist because Chuck insisted.
It was, Chuck knew where the lions were before, after reading the opening paragraph.
We didn't even need to go. We were just like, oh, they're obviously the taxidermist. Oh, man. But we didn't know what was actually going on until Holmes explained it. And that was when I had the most... the experience that was the most similar to why I hated it when I was a kid, trying to read Arthur Conan Doyle's Holmes stories. I'm like, man, I get to the end, and this motherfucker just puts on his stupid hat and is like, hey, well... If you didn't manage to make this leap and then this leap and then this leap and then this leap, then you're just an idiot, right? And I hadn't even made the first leap as a 10-year-old. I'm like, I feel like I'm a smart kid. Why can't I figure this out the way that he does? Because it's
unlike when you were a kid, we actually had all those newspapers. The problem was that two cases ago, there was a case about, or no, one case ago, the previous case, there had already been a case about a jewel thief, but you were supposed to go back and look for other jewel thieves in the newspaper, yeah. Not the one that you solved the week before, but something else that happened, you know, like a month ago, and then a couple of weeks after that, and then there was a side mention of another jewel thief in last week's case, and you were supposed to... Holmes only went to like two spots during the case. Everything else that he did was just by looking through the newspapers.
Here's right. what I learned in that case, and that means I added a fifth page to my notebook. And that fifth page was all crime that has occurred in London going back to the beginning of time.
All crime. That's awesome. And totally, ever. Yeah, you're totally right. Because in case two, we wouldn't have wondered why André/Pierre Matin, or however you pronounce his name, why was he killed? Who did it? We wouldn't have wondered. We would have just gone back a month ago or 2 months ago in the newspaper, one case ago, and seen, oh, well, actual Pierre is dead. This really is André. And this guy that we randomly followed up to his house and saw his like servant polishing his boots, well, he must have killed both of them because we know he's got the diamond, right? Like, we just yep. we hadn't been fastidious about the crime record.
Happily, we didn't need it for that case, and that was sort of the problem with it, is that after having done that case, it was like, oh, it would have been helpful to have had that newspaper article from before, but we still solved that last case without actually having read back through the prior newspaper.
Right. Well, what we solved was who killed the lions. That's all we knew. Right. The other answers, such as what the hell was actually going on, you know, we knew the first line of what Holmes had to say when he explained what happened. The other four paragraphs, we were like, cool, dude, that's news to us.
We also solved the case.
Oh, there were jewels inside these lions' bodies. Who knew? We had no idea, but we know why they got killed, or who did it, I mean, right? We knew who pulled the trigger and who saw it, and that was it.
Yeah, that's the best part about all of this, is how most of these cases, like, it's great and everything that we know who did this, but we'd never be able to prove it. Like,
right, yeah.
Most of the cases, it's all just like...
That's for Lestrade to do.
Well, it's the Holmesian explanation that they want you to get to, right? They don't want the Lestrade or the Watson, like, they don't want the evidence that's going to close the case. Or, I mean, that's going to, like... equip the prosecution for a conviction. They just want that moment at the end of the scene, like that the end of the Law and Order episode or whatever, where they cut away. Yeah.
And all we could provide was, we have got a suspect who has a motive, this motive that we've cooked up that turns out to be wrong, but whatever, it's a motive.
Right, yeah.
And he does not have a good alibi. So there you go, he did it.
See our episode on bad detectives for more information.
We're different kinds of bad detectives here, but dunking on Case 5 is like almost too easy. Case 5 is is hot trash, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, like, if you're Case 5 starts with a cipher that you have to... What is it? A Caesar cipher that you have to solve before you can
do anything. But you don't. It looks like one, but you don't. You can sit there for an hour and a half.
2 hours for me. 2 hours.
Yeah. And then you're like, well, I'm just going to solve this. And then once I've solved this, I'll go on with the rest of the case. And you're just like puzzling through it. And then freaking like, you know, like ditzy girl who came down with us to the beach, like looks over your shoulder and it's like, why are the words like vertical like that? And what's with the rest of all of the other strange letters around them?
Listen, just remember though, if Dirk on Agent Keep Bodkin Near, those Sikh who ready know. This case. And, the typo, a knife angel came on Spurp to kiss you. It's supposed to be spirit. Let's be clear here. If you, instead of using frequency counting and like cryptology theory, you just figure out that they're all like, all E's are A's and every other letter just back up four letters. If you figure that out, fine. You wasted way less time. Regardless, if you spent an hour and a half or 2 hours like I did by just using frequency counting and crypto theory and like then making educated guesses until you brute force your way to the solution, there's still a fucking typo in the end that says spurped instead of spirit, as if that didn't already make it hard enough to decode this cipher. Then when you get to the end, the decoded version doesn't even fucking matter. You're supposed to look at the raw text and listen to either like your logic that says look at every fifth letter in the top row and then read them down, or listen to what Holmes says. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, I'm absolutely certain that's right. You're supposed to listen to that or just figure it out on your own. But all this effort you put into the decoded version, it's just like wasted time for one, and it's the infinity red herrings for two when you go to Holmes and he says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, the number 5 is the key. I'm like looking at every fifth letter in the translated version, in the decoded version. I'm looking at every fifth word. I'm starting at the end of each line and looking at every fifth letter backwards. I'm starting at the very end and counting every fifth letter from the end, like not counting the number of lines. Like, I wasted so much damn time on this decoded cipher when it turns out the decoded version doesn't matter at all. I fucking hate this case.
Yeah. Did either of you guys the victim, he had a label on his trousers?
Oh dude, that this is damn twist of a knife. I was so frustrated.
What was up with that?
Let me explain. His tailor is Poole and Son. Uh-huh. And if you look up tailors in the yellow pages of the directory, there's one Poole and Company. And if you go there, not only do they say, hey, we're not Poole and Son, we're Poole and Company, the guy behind the counter does it in the most obnoxious way. He's like,
do you see what it says on our sign?
He like takes you back outside and points at the sign.
I wanted Wiggins to like stab this dude. That was so frustrating.
Yeah, at the end of that passage, it's like you feel disappointed in yourself for not being detail oriented, and I'm like, fuck that.
Oh my god,
you know what? Disappointed in the game.
The most frustrating thing about Case 5 is that I was more excited at the beginning of it than any of the other four that I've played so far. Right? I've got this cipher. I've got this list of directions that I'm going to figure out. You know, I've got this like hotel address that I'm going to decide. How important is all this stuff? I'm going to crack this code before I even move on in the case. I'm going to look at the newspaper. I see the date May 5th. I'm going to see what happens on May 5th. Blah, blah, blah. I've got all this info to start on before I even follow up a single lead. And I felt so equipped to master this thing. And I went down all the wrong avenues because I just didn't happen to choose the right ones. And 2 hours in, I start going to talk to leads. And then I get to Poole and Company, 3 hours in, and he's like, no, you're in the wrong pool, and blank. I'm like, it was so frustrating, but I was so excited when I started. I thought, I'm going to destroy this solo. I'm going to crush it. I'm going to get the better score than any of my friends. And then by the end, I'm like, I just didn't happen to realize what I was supposed to look at in this stupid code. I felt so cheated. I wanted my 5 hours back.
So I think I beat you guys in case three by like 5 points. I will not even tell you how many negative points I had in case five.
I ended up with like 15, because, and I think Michael got what, like 40 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got more than that negative.
No!
did either of you figure out the directions?
I did, except that I thought it was leading to the hotel, and there was some kind of a typo in that code. I'm like, well, they've made huge game-breaking mistakes with individual letters in other cases, so where it says left here, they must have just meant right. He's clearly leaving the hotel and turning right. And what I was supposed to do was look at the map and see, oh, well, if he turned left, there's only one location that it could be. And since he's only got a ticket for one day, but he's been here for a week, then he must be coming out of that location. I get that that was supposed to figure that out, but the game has conditioned me to assume that they made a mistake with what's written in the book rather than question the facts again.
Also, what, like, how do you know where, like, the orientation of the hotel anyways?
So the way that you're supposed to figure it out is that he has the cigar from
Simpsons. No, yeah. I crushed the directions like instantly. I was done with that in 5 minutes.
That leads you to his where he lives, which is where you figure out like the whole name thing. Ugh.
Yeah.
That's the other thing is that the logical leap to figure out that his full name, like, ugh. No.
I got that, too. I got that because I Googled who are Napoleon's marshals, and one of them was named MacDonald, and MacDonald was originally from Scotland, but Scotland. His family moved to France. The actual historical figure, MacDonald, the marshal of Napoleon's army in the French Republic, right, in the early 1800s. That's how I got that, with Google and Wikipedia, not from the book.
Yeah.
And then how did I waste another half hour or an hour? The note said May 5th, even though that was in the future. So I assumed that was a reference to something that would happen on May 5th. Good half hour looking through all five editions of the newspaper for a May 5th. Nothing. How do I spend the other half hour? Well, a guy at the cigar company said, well, he leaves here every day to do something at about 5 o'clock. 4:45 to be exact, every day. So I spent, because I couldn't figure out where he could possibly be referring to, you know, in the information I had uncovered so far, I looked through every edition of that newspaper, all five, for anything that ever happened at 5 o'clock or maybe 4:45. Nothing. I just didn't happen to crack the cipher, and that was the ultimate gatekeeper for your true understanding of what's going on, right? Like, I got to the end and I had figured out Moriarty was involved because one of your contacts that you can go through, like the rulebook contacts, he said, well, I heard that Moriarty's involved, and I had also heard from someone else that a message was delivered by a guy with a top hat. I'm like, well, that's obviously Moriarty. So I knew he was involved. I had no idea how until I got to the end and Holmes explained it all.
Yeah. Nah.
So we fucking hate this game, huh?
Well, so here's the deal. We fucking hate this game, but I still want to play.
Yeah.
I still want to get together with you guys and play another case.
It's like sex, right? Like even when you're in the middle of it, even terrible sex is awesome. And then like as soon as you're done, it's, oh god, what did I just do, right? Like everything is clear. It all, once it comes over you at the end, like your true understanding, it's so horrifying. But in the middle of it, god, it's awesome.
So this is a good bad detective game, whereas Bad Detectives is a bad detective game.
Maybe that's
correct.
It right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't regret the time that I spent, right? Because even getting done with case five, which left me the most frustrated, I'm like, okay, well, I could have gotten it, and I see where I didn't, and I had fun from hours, you know, zero to two and a half, right? I should have just stopped spinning my wheels after about a half hour of not making any progress. I should have just done that. I don't know. I want to play the rest of it. I want to play all 15 cases that I haven't played.
Yeah. And I definitely want to play them with other people. But there's one thing I've learned with this game, and it does not make you feel smart. It makes you feel lost and confused.
The smartest that I have felt playing this game was playing that very first case where we went through everything and we were like, have we gone down the Russian connection? Let's figure out, oh, look, this girl, the wife of the German ambassador actually is his mistress. And it didn't matter about the fact that we took 24 leads in order to do it. We found out everything about the case, and that made me feel smart.
I think I agree with you, right? I think our approach the next time should just be, well, just if we just happen to, as a group, make these insane deductive leaps, Holmes style, then let's leave open the possibility of flipping to the end and trying to score 80 or 100 points or whatever. But if not, let's just investigate as much as we want to investigate and not sweat how many points we're going to score. I think that'll lead us to the best outcome.
Yeah, I like how we occasionally we would do the thing where we would say, okay, at this point, we visited 5. Let's lock in our answers.
Yeah.
Let's just keep going.
Right. Yeah.
And then we'll see how we would have done if we had, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
that's probably it, right? I mean, we'll probably have a 6 through 10 spoiler cast waiting to go once we get done with the rest of it. Unless they're all great. Who knows?
I think there's an exclusive club of people who have played all of these. And I would love to just hang out and talk with people who have played these cases. And
agree.
Just bitch about them.
I really want to. I want to play this game in the same room as my cousin who gave me his copy of this while he's doing something or other else, so that I can go over to him and been and said, "Hey, listen, we've been sitting here for 15 minutes. We just want to find the location of the armory, and we can't find it in the directory. You remember what happened,
right?"
And he can say, "Oh, yeah, I remember. It's somewhere other down there in the southwest. Just look for whatever the street number is."
Well, what you specifically want him to say is, "Oh, no, that's not you. That's bullshit. They should have explained that you might find a location in this method, but they just didn't." That's why,
right,
yeah, it would be awesome to have him there for that.
Exactly.
Or what would be better is if the game didn't do that.
Yes.
yes, that would be better, but lacking that, the way that you can ensure that is someone else has already, gone through that slog.
Well, the problem is that, obviously what we really want is to play more cases of the perfect version of this game, but the perfect version of this game has been poked at from infinite directions by infinite people, right? Maybe they playtested the original writing of this case with, 20 different groups of 5 people each, and not a single one of them didn't make the connection, 12 Deverell Street, let's go there, right? Maybe 20 playtest groups just didn't have that problem, and then we did on number 21. Or, 1,000 other groups obviously did after the game was released, but, right, the perfect version of this that is mistake-proof, I'm sure it just can't exist.
I think we should volunteer to be that cousin for everybody out there who's going to play this. We can be the Sherlock Holmes consulting detective consulting detectives.
Well,
and if the, anybody has a, is stuck and they want a spoiler-free nudge in the right direction,
then
they
show
can just
at dissection.com. Also, you're going to have to cut out this chunk of our conversation from the spoiler cast version, and you're going to have to put it at the beginning of the episode. Because the people who haven't played the game yet, they're not listening right now.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I'm also willing to do that public service. I'll be part of that. Because we already fell that grenade for our viewers.
Yeah. I'll cut this clip out, and I'll post it all over social media.
The rest of this episode that we have now already recorded is awesome. Keep listening. We should cut it here. Dude, it's late as hell, right?
It is 1:40 a.m.
Yeah, that's real late if you have kids. So we already said goodbye, so goodbye for good. Later.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.